Okay. We'll move on to agenda paper 8 on taxes.
Yes.
Okay, Takashi. So the next topic, agenda paper 8. This agenda paper discusses an issue relating to the presentation of income tax consequences of interest payments on and issuing costs of financial instruments that are classified as equity, and whether those tax effects should be presented in profit loss or directly in equity. As a result of the analysis, we noted that in accordance with the general principle in paragraph 57 of IS-12, the presentation of income tax consequences should be determined on the basis of the presentation of the transactions or events themselves that give rise to those income tax consequences. We also noted that with respect to income tax consequences arising from distribution on financial instruments that are classified as equity, in accordance with the requirement of paragraph 52B, an entity would have to determine whether the income tax consequences are linked to past transactions or events that were recognized in profit and loss or to the distribution itself in assessing the presentation of the tax consequences. And based on these requirements, we thought that the presentation of any tax effects arising from the cost of issuing equity securities should be presented directly in equity. This is because the transaction itself, which in this case the issuing cost, is presented in equity in accordance with paragraph 35 of IS 32. With respect to the income tax consequences of interest payments, we considered whether or not those tax consequences are linked to past transactions events that were recognized in profit loss. On the basis of analysis, we are of the view that income tax consequences distribution that is considered in this paper would not be linked to past transactions events. This is because we thought that unlike dividends, the interest payments that trigger tax deduction are not dependent on the existence of retained earnings, because they are often calculated multiplying the face value of the instrument by a certain percentage. And we also thought that tax effects arising from these interest payments are not associated with anything other than the interest payments themselves. Consequently, we noted that these tax consequences are not linked to past transaction events, but instead related to the distribution itself. And therefore, we concluded that any tax effects arising from the distribution should be presented in equity. Even though this issue is common in certain jurisdictions and there is diversity in practice to some degree, we think that our conclusion can be drawn from the principles in IS-12. Consequently, we recommend that the Interpretations Committee should not take this issue onto its agenda. So the questions to you are, do you agree with the staff analysis and the staff recommendation that you should not take this issue onto its agenda? And if you do you agree with the proposed wording in the appendix?
Hung Su?
I'm kind of agree that with the staff analysis that the interest has the characteristic different from dividend. I agree with that, but I'm not quite sure whether the income tax consequence of the interest payment of the financial instrument classified as equity should be classified into equity. I have about 3 points. The first one is that both the interest and the dividend are deducted from the retained earnings. So very similar. And I do not see much difference between the common stock and the financial instrument classified as equity, at least in accounting sense. We treat them exactly the same as an equity. And the thirdly, what I'm really worrying about is that if we take the conclusion, what I think is that accounting would seem to be very inconsistent. What I'm saying is that income tax for the dividend of common stock is going to be recognized as an expense. But income tax consequence of the interest payment from the bond is going to be recognized as an equity. So something from the stockholders are expenses, but something from the bondholders are equity, which doesn't seem to me, you know, quite exactly what we are expecting in accounting. So that's what I'm thinking about the stuff, you know, conclusion.
Andrew?
Thanks. I like a lot of the analysis in the paper. I do have a think that a better course of action would be to pursue a narrow scope amendment to IAS 12 on this. And the way I see it is that the main principle on presentation of tax effects is in paragraph 58, paragraph 61, and says that the tax effects are presented in the same place as the transaction that gave rise to the tax effects. So I agree in this case that would take me to presentation within equity. But then we've got this 52 capital A, capital B guidance on distributed versus undistributed profits, which is the discussion of tax rates, which, as currently drafted, does seem to overlap with 58 and 61 and has a rather confusing cross-reference to that other piece of guidance. So I think we need to clarify the applicability of 52 A and B. And I kind of agree with the analysis that says that 52A and B apply when the substance of the payment is a distribution of profits to owners. Where I kind of get off with the analysis is that the conclusion in the staff paper very much rests on whether we're in a realized profit or distributable profits regime. So you get a different answer depending on whether company law says you're in a solvency regime to pay dividends or a distributable profits regime to pay dividends. That doesn't seem to me to be pertinent to whether the substance of the transaction is a distribution of profits to shareholders. The paper refers to, I think Jong Soo made similar comments, interest payments on equity instruments. Well, that's inherently a bit confusing to me. We don't call these or present these payments on equity instruments as interest. That's why they're equity instruments, not debt instruments. So I think that might just be terminology, but I think that's going to be a source of confusion based on the current drafting. I'm also not quite sure, quite a common situation is where you've got, maybe it's a preference share, there's a stated rate of interest or dividends, 5%, but that's only payable under company law if there are distributable profits. So is that an interest payment or a dividend payment? So I think we need to clarify the interaction between 52 and 58 in IAS 12.
Tony?
Very similar to Andrew. I kind of understand where the paper's gone, but I think it, to my mind, it made a critical assumption, which is that you can make the payment without there being distributable profits. I think plenty of these require the existence of distributable profits, which to my mind at least creates a question of whether this is closer to being a dividend in the context of 52A and B. There are plenty of these where the actual trigger for making a payment is the payment of a dividend. So there are a number of dividend pusher arrangements that meet the definition of equity, because you only make the payment when you declare a dividend. So I don't think there is a clear distinction. I think something else the paper says is that, well, there's not a different tax rate. I think zero is a different tax rate. If you get a tax deduction for making this payment, then the tax on that is zero. And I think that is a tax rate. So I didn't find the analysis persuasive. I think that we would be better trying to determine whether there is a distinction between a dividend on an ordinary share and a distribution on an instrument that is classified as equity, but the payments, you know, aren't described as dividends, because as Andrew and Jung were both said, well, we're accounting for it like it is. So I think I would prefer to take it on and try and see if we can find where that line is.
John?
Yeah, similar sort of views. I mean, I don't think it's as clear I mean, I like the analysis, and I think the analysis arrives at the right decision. I really think that the tax effect of these payments should be in equity, because I think 52A and B is actually dealing with a situation where you have a differential tax rate between undistributed and distributed profits, and I don't think that's what this is. I think this is the deductibility of a distribution, so I think it's actually a different issue. But effectively, you can arrive at exactly the same. You know, you can justify why it's in 52A and B just as easily as you can justify why it's in 58 and 61. So I think an amendment is required. I also think that the relevance of the existence of retained earnings, I don't see that as being relevant at all. There's lots of distributions that are made without any retained earnings. There's lots of jurisdictions where distributions are not out of profits, they're based on solvency or some other measure. There's also lots of interest payments on legally interest payments, which, as Tony says, are actually required profits. So to me, the existence or non-existence of retained earnings is completely irrelevant to this analysis. To me, the 52A and B is trying to say, well, if you had these profits in the past and recognized, you should be recognizing tax on those on the basis of, you know, whether they're distributed or undistributed. It's telling you how to deal with that. And to me, this is a different issue. But I do think a narrow scope amendment is needed to clarify the interaction of the two.
Reinhardt?
Very similar to John's, in the sense that the scope of 52A and B is unclear, but I do agree that it tends to deal with circumstances where you have distributed versus undistributed tax rates, and that's not this scenario. So I would agree that in order to address this, it'd be good to have a narrow scope amendment to describe the applicability of 52A and B compared to paragraph 58 and 61.
Question, is an amendment necessary to do that? Are there, can we interpret
the reason that? The reason I thought an amendment, and I suppose it's worth exploring whether we as a committee can take it on, is as Andrew said, there's a confusing reference to paragraph 58 within 52B. So which takes precedent? Now, maybe that is something that we can deal with, which would suggest, obviously, we need to take it on the agenda then.
Yeah, and either way, in either case, it's not an agenda decision.
Right.
Okay, I'm losing track here, but I think, Bob, you're next.
Okay. I've got very similar takes as others. I'm quite confused on the scope of 52 or when it's something would be classified, when the income taxes would be classified within equity or versus P&L. I'm a bit troubled by the path that the staff was leading me down of it's dependent on whether there's existence of retained earnings. There are many states where jurisdictions where you can make dividend payments without having existing retained earnings, and are we now saying that those would be where would those be classified? So I'm troubled by, you know, having that as the principle. So if that's not the principle, then I'm struggling with, okay, when is a distribution from earnings, past earnings, and when is it not? I think that's the issue that we have to try to get our hands around.
Yeah, especially since it's the distributions of cash.
Yeah.
It's that they don't have labels on them. Sandy and then Marie.
I guess as I read this, I generally believe the tax ought to follow where the transaction is resides. I didn't see really any difference in whether we're calling it interest here or we're calling it dividends on the common stock. I didn't really get the distinction of something's a past transaction. I look at equity and say everything's a past transaction. So I didn't feel like that was, I feel like that's a rule, but I don't think it explains to me what's actually going on. And I get to the notion of, is it distributed or undistributed profits, right? And that there's, all there is a different tax rate on distributed profits. You know, I would generally say that that belongs in equity to follow where it sits, but it does tell you something when it all of a sudden appears in the income statement. What it tells you as a user of the financial statements is that the tax rate's not the same on undistributed and distributed profits. And what you really need to do is go to retained earnings and figure out the difference in the rate, because when you value a company, you can't assume that the earnings will turn into dividends at the same rate. So if the tax rate is 10% more when you distribute it, the value of the company should go down by 10%. So really, I look at it and say, it's telling me a really important valuation question that I really have a big deferred item I've never booked in equity. So I still get back to, I believe it resides in equity, but I don't really get the, it's like we're going through all these machinations to basically tell us that what's in 52 probably isn't the right thing, because I think it belongs in equity. But it does, when it goes to the income statement, it is telling you as a user, hey, pay attention, which you may not pay attention to in equity in the same way, because it'll cause a big permanent item.
Marie?
Just to, we consider it's not possible to deal with in an agenda decision because we flag with there is this tension between paragraph 52 and 58, so it should be either an amendment or a new figure. I mean, it's up to you. We also consider that as it's often linked to dividends, it's on one hand you can see that equity because it's linked to something that goes in equity, but in the other hand, as it often goes with dividends, it's create, as it was said, an inconsistency between what you do is with the tax with dividend and with the tax in this tax in that situation. So, but I think you should take on the agenda because it's something very frequent.
My sense of the comments is that people do want to take this on, although the disposition isn't obvious. At one point in the hallway over lunchtime, I attempted to blame these amendments on Ann McEachin, who informed me that she was not in the employ of the IASB when these amendments were made, so I can't blame them on her. Before I get to that, though, Bonnie, I haven't turned to you on this one. Did you have anything to add?
No, I don't think so. Okay. I think my comments are in line with what the others have mentioned.
My sense is that we want to explore a little more about how 52A and B came into existence and specifically what they're trying to target. I know I found that troubling when I read the paper because, as I say, once you enter into these things, the cash is fungible. So what is it we're trying to pin the tail on with those two paragraphs? I think it was absolutely critical to the analysis. So you'll see this again in March. And whether we need to ask the board for an amendment or whether we can interpret our way out of it, I'm not sure yet, but we'll see. Okay.